Hey everybody, today's episode is sponsored by Penzu, your personal journal in the cloud. Penzu is where millions of people keep their most private thoughts, all locked with a secret password. Go to penzu.com, that's spelled P-E-N-Z-U now, and sign up for a free account. For extra security and fun customizations, go to penzu.com/GoPro on your computer and use promo code Radical for $5 off your Pro or Pro Plus subscription. Once again, that's promo code Radical. Now let's get to the show.
This is The Radical Therapist, a space where we explore the intersections of collaborative therapy, philosophy, art, and science and technology in a post-Freud, post-psychology world.
Welcome to The Radical Therapist, episode 16. This is Chris Hoff, your host, and I'm really excited about today's show. I think you will be too. I was thinking about a couple things in kind of running up to this show with our guest, Sarah Rafael Garcia. And one was I attended the AMFT California conference, and I saw, and there was a lot of great presentations and keynotes, et cetera. But I saw a keynote by Dr. Kiran Arora, and one of the things, she talked about a lot of things, but one of the things that stood out to me was she talked about this idea of centering other forms of healing that stand outside of the traditional kind of white male Western therapeutic model kind of thing. And that I was kind of holding on to that because I think our next guest is one of those kind of healers that I think Dr. Arora was pointing to. And also another thing that I was thinking about, and I've been thinking a lot about, I got introduced to the work of Gloria Anzaldúa through the work of Dr. Ana Louise Keating at Texas Women's University. And Anzaldúa talked a lot or wrote a lot about what she would call a Napantalara. And in Napantalara, she wrote in her book, Speaking Across the Divide, she describes what a Napantalara is. And she writes that this person can move between the worlds. They can work from multiple locations, can circumvent polarizing binaries. They try not to get locked into one perspective or perception of things. They can see through our cultural conditioning and through our respective cultures' toxic ways of life. They try to overturn the destructive perceptions of the world that we've been taught by our various cultures. They change the stories about who we are and about our behavior. They point to the stick we beat ourselves with so we realize what we're doing and may choose to throw away the stick. They possess the gift of vision. And I wanted to read that before we talk to Sarah, because I just think she's a true Napantalara. So let me give you a little bit of Sarah's background before we have the conversation. Sarah Rafael Garcia is a writer, community educator, and traveler. And since publishing Las Niñas, she founded Barrio Writers and obtained an MFA in creative writing. She writes poetry, creative nonfiction, and fiction. Her writing has appeared in Latino Magazine, Contrapuntos 3, Outrage, a protest anthology for injustice in a post-9/11 world, La Tolteca Zine, Lumen Magazine, among others. Most recently, Sarah Rafael was featured in the Femme Literary Magazine and was awarded for Santana's Fairy Tales, which is supported in part by the Andy Warhol Foundation for the Visual Arts, through a grant supporting the Artist in Residence Initiative at Grand Central Art Center in Southern California. Sarah Rafael is currently the editor for the annual Barrio Writers Anthology and co-editor for the forthcoming Pariah's Writing from Outside the Margins Anthology. So let's meet Sarah. Hello, Sarah. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Chris. Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. Thank you for taking the time to chat with me. I'm excited to have you here. I know our listeners. I know you're working in a lot of different spaces that I think our listeners are really going to appreciate. And so I appreciate you taking the time. And I know you're very busy because you have an artist residency coming up here near where I live in Orange County. And so I know there's probably a lot going into preparing for that. So thank you for taking the time.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, I'm looking forward to my artist residency. Yeah. But I also have a lot of free time right now, given that I'm prepping for that. So we're good.
Okay, good. Cool. Good. So I thought, you know, just to kind of start and to give our listeners a little of your background in history, I thought maybe you are currently in Austin, Texas.
Correct.
And I'm ashamed to admit I've never been there, but it's on the list. But you grew up in Orange County, where I am located and near where I'm located. And I was wondering if you could just kind of tell us a little bit about your background and what it was like growing up here in Orange County.
Yeah, well, I was actually born in Brownsville, Texas, which is like the southernmost tip of Texas and Mexico, you know, the Mexican border. I was very fortunate that I was the first in my family born in the United States. My family comes from Matamoros, Tamaulipas, Mexico. And soon after my parents got married and had me, I think I was like 4 years old when we moved to Santa Ana, you know, California. Yeah. And so my whole, you know, childhood, all I remember is Santa Ana. I don't really associate myself as growing up in Brownsville, Texas, or, you know, Texas for that matter. But I always say, like, I come from two valleys, from the Rio Grande Valley and from, you know, the Orange County Valley in California. Right. But at the same time, I was exposed to both cultures, whether it was Mexican or Californian or Texan, you know, Tejana, Texan. And growing up in Santa Ana for me was great. And my childhood memories, I'm very nostalgic. I mean, my writing started about Santa Ana and my first, you know, experiences there. I didn't really know at the time as a child that I was a minority or that, you know, there'd be all these other issues that I encountered as an adult. Because our community was very diverse. You know, my neighbors were Samoans and Tongans and African-American and white and, you know, Vietnamese and Chinese. So I just assumed we were all equally present through, you know, throughout our communities and had a voice. So it wasn't after, until after my father died that I was exposed to a lot of different situations where I realized, you know, I was a minority, whether given by gender or culture, and I was experiencing life a little bit differently than what other my peers were, you know.
What did you notice changed at that time for you? And your father passed away when you were fairly young, right?
Yeah, I was 13, and my youngest sister at the time had just turned 10. So I have, you know, two sisters, and being first generation, you know, U.S. born, there's a lot of like expectations on both sides, right? You know, you have the idea of the American dream. You're supposed to go to college, but no one in our family at the time really knew how. And, you know, my parents had really bad experiences in school when they arrived to the United States. They were like in their teenage years, and they faced ridicule from other also Mexican Americans who knew English. So it was like this, you know, like cycle of oppression going on where, like, since they knew English, they had an upper hand and they treated my parents badly. So both of my parents dropped out of school as soon as they got here and attended for, you know, maybe a year or two. And they both said that they dropped out because of the ridicule. And
wow.
And for, yeah. And so they, I mean, fortunately they went on and got their GED. So growing up and experiencing that and having parents that are, you know, my dad was working class and my mom stayed home and raised us. And, you know, I feel like she had the hardest job because she had to manage a household and three girls. But at the same time, you know, she exposed us to something that I don't know we would have learned otherwise if my father hadn't passed away. You know, to me, growing up and watching my mom go through what she went through from, you know, the idea that she was supposed to be the traditional madre mexicana, you know, raise a home, take care of her husband, take care of her children. And at the age of 32, she lost all of that. And you know, going from like never really being in charge of the house when it comes to money, you know, very minimal work experience as well as, you know, responsibilities. So it kind of like, you know, startled us as women ourselves, where we felt like we have to be more than that. We have to want more than that, because we one day we may not have anybody to depend on. And so I think that was my first idea of like how I had to be different. Outside of my culture, as well as just, you know, being a woman.
Now, is my understanding you, that's when you were got introduced to writing, is during in that kind of transition?
I did. You know, my dad's death was very sudden. It wasn't expected. And so that brought in a lot of different elements in our family, out of our family. And when I was at the hospital, when they were pronouncing my dad dead, he, you know, one of the things that they do is assign a social worker to the case, especially when children are involved. So there was a social worker that was with us. And, you know, of course, me being 13 and, you know, a typical teenager where I'm not going to listen to anybody. And I didn't. I just refused to talk to her. I refused to talk to anybody, actually. And so she gave me the best advice. She gave me a notebook, like a plain, you know, journal notebook, and said, "There's probably no words I can say to you right now to make you talk, but please write. Write everything, you know, write your feelings down, and hopefully one day you'll talk to someone." And I've been writing ever since. And so, you know, because of that experience, and I'm really sad that I don't even know her name, but she changed my life. She put it on a different course, I think. And, you know, compounded with everything else that was going on at home, I just started writing and journaling, and that became very therapeutic, you know. And eventually I went through the phase of writing cheesy, you know, teenage poetry, love poems, you know, but I kept writing, you know. That turned into a collection of diaries that I have from my teenage years. And that continued, you know, something that I continued to do secretly. It was, I didn't really share my writing with many people. Through high school, I wrote, you know, in the school newspaper, and I wrote some short stories that I would share with my mom and my sisters, but that was the extent of sharing that I did for my writing.
Yeah, you mentioned the school newspaper. It was journalism that had you going, you tried to college? Yeah.
So I was initially interested in journalism, but I had no idea how to do it, right? Like, I did, you know, high school newspaper reporting, which was great, but I didn't know what, like where that would take me. It was journalism that got me to a college campus. You know, I started at Irvine Valley College, and they're in Orange County. And it was a great experience for me. I mean, at the time, again, you know, our family didn't know how to go to college. All the, you know, all we knew was like, you have to go to college, but the details behind it were unknown to us. I was fortunate to have another lady, my mom's friend, who saw that I wanted to go. So she took time, and mind you, she was a social worker too.
Oh, wow.
So
wow.
She took time to take me to college campuses, and you know, I didn't have the requirements to go straight to university campus. So I went to community college, and she told me how to register, and you know, and how to choose classes, and then she introduced me to different people in social work that I, because at the time I thought I would want to be involved more actively in social work and journalism, but I didn't know how to combine the two. So yeah, I went to Irvine Valley College, but no one bothered to tell me about financial aid. So, and nobody bothered to ask. I think because at the time, you know, at the time it wasn't the social movement of the Dreamers and AB 540 status wasn't a conversation. You wouldn't ask somebody if they were undocumented. In fact, I didn't even realize that there was undocumented people. It was something that a conversation that just wasn't had. I mean, this is, you know, 1992, right? So when I went to college, people would ask me, "Where are your parents from?" And I would say Mexico, and you know, "What was your first language?" And I would say Spanish, but nobody bothered to ask me if I was an American citizen. So nobody also bothered to ask me if I knew about financial aid. So I paid 4 of my 6 years of undergrad, because it took me that long to save money, take semesters off, and go back to, you know, to taking undergrad classes. So I paid 4 of the 6 out of pocket.
Yeah.
And I was working full time, on average 40 to 60 hours a week. I had 3 jobs my first 2 years at IVC. You know, and it was just a challenge. And sometimes I didn't have money for books. But I had amazing teachers there that were super supportive. And one of them I credit to, you know, my beginning of writing as well. And it's Lisa Alvarez, and she still actually teaches at IVC. Hmm. And she's a writer herself. And she was the first person that said, you know, when I turned in an essay for the class, which was like an intro to writing class, because I didn't have the requirements to go straight into regular English class. And she said, you know, you have the potential of being a writer and you should consider writing. And I didn't tell her at the time that I was already writing. I just wasn't sharing. Okay. So
it was all a secret.
That's where I started at IVC. And you know, and I still have that great experience or great memory from it. And hopefully one day I can go back and teach there.
Hopefully get you back to Orange County. Yeah. So, and you did some, during your undergrad, you did some social work or some family counseling. Yeah. Okay. What was that experience?
So eventually when, you know, when I was, I ended up moving to Texas for a while during those few first years of undergrad. I didn't know where to go to transfer. You would think that I would have looked at my local surroundings, and there's UCI and there's Cal State Fullerton and there's Chapman, but I didn't know anybody that went there. So my idea always was I got to get enough credits and transfer to Texas State University, which was then Southwest Texas State, because I had one family member that went there. Hmm. And I thought, well, if my aunt can get in there, I can get in. You know, I just didn't even see how there was other options in front of me. And so that's what brought me to Texas. And at the time, again, I didn't know anything about journalism enough to say, okay, I can become a journalist. So I ended up switching my major to social work because I went back to like, what do I want to do? I want to help people. I want to help people like my family. I want to help youth, like, you know, go through difficult situations like I did. And so I ended up looking into social work. And when I went to Texas State, when I got accepted in 1996, and I met with my advisor for the first time, the first question she said was, do you have your financial aid all set up? And I had no idea what financial aid was. Mm. And I said, you know, I have $1,600 that I saved. I wanted to see if I could set up a payment plan, but maybe keep a couple $100 because I don't have a job yet and I need some money to get by.
Wow.
And she just looked at me, you know, blonde, blue-eyed advisor. And she just looked at me like, where did you come from? Mm. And then she just said, have you applied to financial aid? And I said, I don't know how that works. And so she took me to the financial aid office. She literally walked me through campus, took me straight there, held my hand throughout the whole process. And then right away, you know, like once they filled out the paperwork and we did everything, she said, okay, we're going to get you set up, but it's going to take a while. So you're going to have to make your first installment. But she's like, the dean's office is going to give you $1,000 to do that as a grant, you know. And then she said, and then you qualify for this grant money because, you know, low income family background, right? And I just started crying because she said I was going to get $1,200, which is the Pell Grant. And I started crying and she's like, oh, don't worry, you're going to get more money. And I started crying even more because I thought $1,200 was amazing. Yeah, right. And then the extra $1,000. And so I just couldn't believe that there was this money available. And that's how I ended up. And she also convinced me to do sociology instead of social work. She says, well, it sounds like you're not sure what you want to do, but sociology is a good direction to go because whatever you choose, the study of human behavior is going to be, you know, something that's going to help you in social work or writing. Hmm. And that's how I ended up doing sociology in undergrad.
Do you think that was solid advice at the time?
Yeah, it was the advisor that really helped. And you know, and for me, it was now in retrospect, I always, you know, I didn't have a Latino or Chicano or Mexican American mentor growing up. You know, my family didn't have higher education. And so my first mentor was a blonde, you know, blue eyed lady. And I just thought that was an amazing experience for me to see that I had someone that was willing to fight for me.
That's great. It was during this graduate undergraduate experience where you started to write your first book, or was it?
No. So I, you know, undergrad took me, I applied, you know, well, undergrad took me through the sociology program and I still had a minor at the time for journalism. I ended up dropping journalism and switching to Spanish out of convenience because I thought, oh, minoring in Spanish is way easier because I could test out a lot of it.
Okay.
And get out sooner because by this time, you know, I'm going into 6 years of undergrad.
Sure.
I did that, but I also learned a hard lesson. Like, taking Spanish was not easy as a native Spanish speaker. At the time, they didn't have Spanish for native Spanish speakers, which some universities have now. But it was a great experience. I learned a lot about myself and how much I knew and my language, and it kind of helped me learn what I hadn't learned, which was like, you know, reading and writing a little bit more extensively, as well as how to use accents in Spanish. So I was part of a group there that was initially a writing group, and it started out because I tried to join like Mecha or LULAC. But I passed for white. I don't know if it was my hazel eyes, or I don't know if it was just at the time it was winter and my skin wasn't brown yet. You know, I don't know. But they rejected me. They said, you know, one group in particular told me, "I'm sorry, this is just for Mexican Americans." And so I felt rejected by my own culture. So I ended up meeting another writer in the Spanish program, and he was forming a writers group for Spanish, you know, writers for the Spanish language. So he definitely didn't have to have a Latino background to be part of it. You just had to have an interest in writing in Spanish. Mm. And so I started there, but I didn't really workshop with them or share my writing there either. I just, you know, we organized and brought writers to campus and stuff like that. And so then I graduated and I started doing social work, and I worked helping, you know, with teenagers, since, you know, that was my interest. And through undergrad, I was already working at a 24-hour locked facility. It's a rehabilitation center for youth, which is like an alternative to juvenile detention. It was an opportunity for youth to obtain counseling and behavioral therapy instead of being locked up in juvenile detention. So I had all these years of experience that I built up through undergrad time, and as well, once I got out, that's what I kept doing. But I realized then the bureaucracy behind of it and the way systems worked was still treating kids like numbers versus offering therapy. Mm. And that's what took me away from social work, was the bureaucracy behind it. And then I got into national marketing, and that's what I was doing for a while. And it wasn't until I was at a high position in corporate America. I was still middle management, but I was working my butt off there. Getting paid for 40 hours, but working about 60. But I had the American dream. You know, my parent and my mom and my family were really proud. I was working in the 29th floor of the Macy's building in downtown LA, had the Hollywood sign for my cubicle staring at me every day, you know, and it was something like, wow, I finally did it. I finally got the job that my dad would tell me, like, you have to get the jobs like the white people so you can dress nice, drive a nice car, and not have to worry about being dirty or doing, you know, labor work. But once I was there, I realized, like, this isn't making me happy. I had money, but I didn't have time to spend it. I was working constantly. It was, you know, definitely causing me to have different mental issues. Like, I was having, you know, the ideas of, like, I don't know, am I doing this right? Because I don't really have a mentor telling me this is the way I'm going to do it. You know, I had one of my aunts married a man who is also white and super business savvy, and I would call him and ask him questions because I didn't know if this is the way that things were supposed to go at work. Hmm. But it was also very stressful, and I ended up having anxiety issues and stuff because of other things happening in my life as well, and being compounded with working a lot of hours. And it was that drove me back to writing. I was doing writing there, but it was all technical writing. I had been, when I was doing marketing, doing technical writing and, you know, writing project descriptions and product descriptions and stuff like that. And that's why I liked that type of job. But I finally had enough. And a lot of my friends were young professionals, and I asked them for advice. And I said, you know, one day when I was mad at work, I applied to teach English in China. I didn't even update my resume. I sent them a marketing resume. And I said, I want to teach English in China because I can get away from all of this. And I got accepted. So then I asked my friends, I'm like, what do I do? Do I leave this job and do I go live in China? And that's what I did. And so I used China as an excuse to start writing again. Wow. I said, if I'm going to leave my country and I'm going to leave my family, it has to be for a bigger dream. You know, not the typical or stereotypical American dream, right? So I said, I'm going to go finally write that book that I've been wanting to write. And that's how I did. I went to China, lived there for a year and a half. Technically, it was supposed to be for 6 months to a year, and turned into 18 months. It changed me completely. Everything from, you know, realizing that a fancy wardrobe wasn't necessary, to not having to drive a car, you know, taking public transportation. It made me appreciate life a whole lot more. And that's where I wrote my first book.
And you wrote the whole book there in China, huh?
I did. Yeah. I wrote the whole book there. I wrote it very slowly because I didn't want a reason to have to come back to America.
And for our listeners, we're talking about Los Niños is the...
Las Niñas, yeah. And it was... A lot of things were happening in my life that were changing me there. And I've always wanted to write a book about our childhood because, you know, so many people told us, because you lost your dad at such a young age, you and your sisters have been empowered by that. And, you know, that's why you're so independent. And I'm like, no, I mean, it's because we had such a great childhood with both of my parents. And they're the ones that instilled culture in us and dedication and the goals to obtain more out of life. You know, I go, yes, my father had an impact. And in many ways, there was other things that I learned from that experience that put me in a different course in life, but it's not because of his death that I am so bonded to my sisters or culture. You know, it's because of his life and what him and my mother started with us.
Now, after that, offline, we had had a little conversation and you had kind of shared a little bit about, then you decided to get an MFA. Did that happen after you came back from China? Yeah, okay. And that wasn't such a great experience for you, as I understand it.
No. It made me it triggered so many memories of like learning English in the American school system. And since we didn't move to Santa Ana till I was four, I didn't learn English until I got to Santa Ana. Spanish was my first language, and you know, I grew up with my grandparents around me, so that was the only language I spoke, the first language I learned to speak. And you know, I went to the MFA for many reasons, and one of them was because I had started Badger Writers, and a lot of the things that I was encountering was that people were telling me like, oh, we can't use the Body Writer's book in the classrooms, or we can't pay you to do workshops. Cause I was getting invited to do workshops, to teach teachers how I teach in Body Writers, but I wasn't being offered an honorarium or any source of payment.
Because you didn't have a master's degree or?
Yes. Okay. Cause I didn't have a master's degree or I wasn't certified as a teacher, or I didn't have a PhD to say that I can produce such curriculum, you know?
And you started Barrio Writers before you went to your master's program then?
Yes. Okay. I started Barrio Writers less than a year after my book came out.
Oh, okay.
I should backtrack a little bit, but so when Las Niñas came out in 2008, I returned to Santa Ana after being gone for like 20 years. Wow. After my dad died, the first thing my mom did was move us to a new neighborhood. Part of it was that she wanted to give us better education opportunities. The other part was she wanted just to flee everything that reminded her of that life, right, with my father. Mm. I left when I was like 14, and I went back, I guess, in my early 30s. So it was literally almost 20 years later. And I went back solely to show my community what was produced. You know, I was labeled as an at-risk kid, even more so after my dad died. I wasn't one that people thought it was going to go to college. People thought I would end up pregnant and married really early in life because of the boyfriend I had at the time. And so when I went back, I thought, like any artist, right? Oh, my book's going to change the world and it's going to impact so many people because I'm writing about my culture and my childhood and my trauma. But it didn't, because I was an adult, and you know, the last thing teenagers want to hear is another adult telling them what to do and how to do it and telling them like how, you know, they're not the only ones. And I learned that quickly after presenting on a couple campuses, and I felt like a failure to the youth. I'm like, I forgot what it was like to be a teenager. And then that's how Badger Writers came about. And I said, what would have helped me when I was a teenager, therapy-wise, right? You know, because one of the reasons that I was so traumatized by my father's death, and then I didn't know this till after I was writing my book, but I was mute for 3 or 4 days after his burial, and nobody bothered to tell me or remind me. I didn't remember. I had these visions in my head of that, you know, I thought I made them up. Like, this is what I wanted to do because I was so traumatized by watching his burial that I ran through I ran to the coffin. I wouldn't let them lower it. I ran through the cemetery away from the situation, and my uncle had to get me. I had this, like, this is what I pretended I did, right? But when I wrote it in my book, my sister at the time was doing content editing. And I sent it to her with, you know, be careful because this chapter is about dad's burial. And then she had to call me and say, I need to talk to you. And she said, that thing that you said you envisioned yourself doing this and you wished you could have, she's like, you did that. She's like, you didn't envision that. You actually did that. And then she's the one that told me. And this happened, like, again, almost 20 years after, or I guess, yeah, almost 20 years after my dad died. She's telling me that this really did happen to me and that they didn't know what was going to happen to me because I stopped eating. I stopped talking. Mm. I was just like a zombie walking around where people were telling me to go. But my family never confronted that. And they never told me that I had that traumatic episode as a teenager. And I remember when I snapped out of it after my sister and I talked about it. And it was somebody was picking on my sister. And that's when I felt like I had to start talking again, was just to defend my sister. And so that itself, I started thinking when I was thinking about body writers, I'm like, okay, so my book, my story is not going to change them or their situation or empower them to do something differently. So what would? And I thought, if I knew somebody was going through similar things when I was going through them, and it was normal to have these type of reactions, then I would feel empowered by that. That I would feel normal. I wouldn't feel crazy. I wouldn't have gone through my suicidal thoughts, you know, because at least I know that somebody else is going through it and surviving it. And that's how Body Writers got started. I just wanted to create a space where youth can talk to each other, share their stories, and then share their stories with adults so that we can understand where they're coming from and respect their opinions. And I was fortunate at the time to be partnered with a high school teacher, and he was very instrumental in helping me create this pedagogy for body writers.
Where did you do the first one?
In Santana.
Oh, you did?
All right. Started, okay. Yeah. We started in El Centro Cultural de Mexico, which was a wonderful space to launch the program, and they have continuously been supportive of us. Even when we lost our space at Cal State Fullerton, I guess like 2 years ago now, they reopened to us and let us host body writers there again. So we started there, and honestly, we didn't even know if we were going to get youth to attend. Even up to the day, I was like, well, I hope, you know, some youth show up. We had 30 teenagers show up to the first workshop.
That's great.
And out of the 30, we retained 27. Out of the 27, 20 got published in the first edition. And this goes back to, like, okay, what happened after that? Fast forward, you know, is trying to align myself with school districts and universities and getting my lack of credibility thrown in my face for not being able to sustain the program, right?
Right.
I'm not a certified teacher. I didn't have a master's degree. I didn't have a PhD. And that's what took me to the MFA, because I thought, how am I going to fortify this program if I'm the weak link in it, you know? And so when I wasn't sustainable, my lifestyle wasn't sustainable in Santana, like, I couldn't find a job. And that would also give me the time to do body writers. I moved to Texas because, you know, at that time, my sisters already had relocated here to start their own families because, you know, cost of living is way different.
Yes, right.
And I started, you know, building another platform here in Austin, my experience here in Austin with body writers has been very different than my experience in California. Here we have all the resources, you know, I'm supported by the Center of Mexican American Studies at University of Texas, but our challenge is getting the youth here. Wow. We're in California.
The youth
show
up.
That's not an issue.
Oh, okay. Wow.
Yeah.
What do you think the difference is?
I don't know. I mean, I can speculate, and, you know, the reason I want to seek a PhD is to write about where the differences are in every chapter. Hmm. My speculation on this one is that it's the layers of oppression, you know?
Sure.
The social movements have, especially with the Dream Act and with the undocumented, you know, queer groups as well in Santana, and the amazing community organizers there, it's building, you know, momentum for the youth, and the youth have are leaders now. You know, it's not like they're looking for leaders. They're becoming the role models. They're becoming the leaders in the social movements. Whereas in Texas, it's not as prevalent. There's youth that still use the term Hispanic as their race and culture. And they don't know where the word started, and they don't realize that you're not half Hispanic. You're half Mexican, maybe, or half, you know, Latino of some, you know, from whether you're from Ecuador or Argentina, you know. And so I think it's just the layers of oppression in Texas, you know, and there's a lot of segregation here still, as there is in parts in California. But I think it's, we're talking about, you know, a lot of different ways, you know, that different things Mexican Americans have faced here in Texas, you know. Especially because, you know, here the culture is very different too. You know, Tex-Mex talk or Tejano or Spanglish is used interchangeably a lot, you know. Whereas growing up for me in Santa Ana, my mom would say, choose one language when you speak, either English or Spanish. There was no code switching allowed, or that she didn't like us to code switch or use Spanglish. You know, we didn't say troca, we said camioneta, because troca is Spanglish, you know. Yeah. Whereas here in Texas, if you say camioneta, they're like, what, y'all, you mean a troca? So it's a little different.
Okay. So then you decided to go get that MFA, and that was not a great experience.
Yeah.
I was trying to seek legitimacy.
It's a coping mechanism when I laugh about it.
Yeah.
I went to apply for an MFA. I based my applications on how much the application cost to submit, where it was located, and how easy it would be for me to get there. Right.
Yeah.
So I only applied to three, and Texas State University was one of them. I was very familiar with the campus. I had a great undergrad experience. So I figured, what can go wrong? Right. The disadvantage of the program was I didn't really know many of the writers on faculty. I only knew one, put it that way, at the time. And it was a 3-year program versus 2-year. It wasn't funded for me. But I could get some teaching experience, and I said, "Oh, okay. Well, this will help with body writers. If I could say I taught at a university, then that would sound better when I'm trying to, you know, make body writers sustainable." So I went, and it was a lot of things happened that I didn't expect, and one of them, you know, being that Texas State is in Central Texas, and the state that is 55% not white. Where Mexican culture is everywhere. I mean, breakfast tacos are a hit here, right? And, you know, we have an abundance of events and cities that celebrate Mexican culture. On campus alone, they host the Tomas Rivera Children's Book Award that, you know, is in honor of Tomas Rivera, who was, you know, a child of migrants, who worked on the fields himself. So I just expected some of that to be part of the program. I was foolish. I should have done my homework. What I found instead was that the program was predominantly white. Some of my peers in my cohort, you know, stated, or one, should I say, in particular, stated that the use in Spanish and writing alienated him as a reader. In workshop, I found that we were spending more time on how we use Spanish, because there was, you know, at the time there was a couple of us that did it, or two of us, right? Would use Spanish in our writing, and the issue was always like, should you italicize? Should you not italicize? Should you translate? Should you not translate? And instead of focusing on plot and writing style and characterization, on the reasons why we go to an MFA program. And my language became the issue in workshop, and my culture did too, because they're like, oh, you have stereotypical characters, or, oh, your character's not Mexican enough. And these were from people that don't know my culture. They only know what they see on TV and what they read in the newspaper. So it was a culture shock. And unfortunately, I was also dealing with other insecurities of, you know, I didn't go to some of the great schools that they went to. I went to Texas State, and I thought it was a great school because it was the only university I knew at the time.
Yeah, right.
You know, I was older. I entered the program at 37. There was one writer in the program who was 20. So I couldn't help but laugh and say, oh my God, I could totally be your mom. And I'm in your workshop with me, you know? And so I had this culture shock completely. And I also didn't find at the time the staff were very supportive. You know, I had one professor tell me that I wasn't quite writing fiction yet, which I thought was astonishing, because then why did you accept me if I wasn't writing fiction? I applied to a fiction program.
Right.
So it, a lot of instances of microaggressions based on, you know, gender and race throughout the workshop, which led me to be very angry and traumatized by it. You know, and I got very, unfortunately, I also got very sick my first semester. And now in retrospect, I probably associated with stress and the level of anxiety I was going through.
Right.
At the time, I just really thought I was just having, you know, other issues. Which I was. I mean, I had to change my eating lifestyle because of it. But I'm sure it was triggered by the stress that I was going under as well.
Sure. Okay. So, what did you do after? I mean, how did you kind of respond to that experience?
Well, some of my coping mechanisms during during the program, the 3 years I was there, was literally just to shut up and shut down. Yeah. You know, so I was more concerned about my health in some parts of the program. So I just started just going through the motions instead of actively participating. I started avoiding my peers. So I was taking classes they weren't taking, so I wouldn't be in the same workshop, mm-hmm. which is, you know, a bad thing to do when you're paying for your education. You should feel free and have every right to be in the classroom that you want to be in. But I didn't want to go through that again. So I was making sure that my last couple workshops were with the cohort that came in after me instead of the cohort I was a part of. You know, I started asking, you know, every year we'd get invited to put writers on our list for who would we wish to come to campus. I started putting, you know, Chicano writers on the list. But I really wasn't having a great experience, and I didn't know what else to do. And so I also started doing study abroad. And I think honestly, the study abroad program is what saved me, because had I not had to gone to Germany my first summer to make up for a class that I had an incomplete in because I was sick, I had to make up that credit over the summer to be able to be a teacher, you know, a teaching assistant the following semester. And I needed that money, right? So I was like, okay, I have to make this work. So I went to Germany on a study abroad program through the English department, and I did media studies, which for me was new because I'm not a movie enthusiast, but you know, I was like, I can do this. And I did, and I had a great time, and the professor I studied under was amazing, and she was a feminist, and we started deconstructing female narratives on the screen as well as in books. And I really... It shed light on what I wanted to do. I mean, that's what Las Niñas does, right? It focuses on three girls that had to deal with losing the patriarchy, right, in their household,
right.
And their mother having to rise up and be a different woman that she expected herself to be. Hmm. And so part of that, I wanted to continue in my writing. So that helped. And then eventually when it was time to choose my thesis director and what I was going to write about, I had workshopped my writing sample that I had submitted to the program throughout for the first 2 years. And it kept getting torn apart, put back together. Culturally, my voice was changing. I was minimizing my Spanish. I went debated between italicizing, not italicizing, between translating and not translating, to the point where I was just sprinkling in the Mexican essence instead of writing what I wanted to write.
Yeah.
So I decided not to write that for my thesis. I changed my thesis completely, which forced me to write my thesis in 3 months instead of the the 2.5 year time.
Yeah, right. So you work better under pressure, I take it.
Yeah. And it wasn't till the summer before my last year that I made this change. And the summer before my last year in the program, I went to Ireland with the study abroad program. And Ireland was a country I've always wanted to go to. It was an idea that my father instilled in me. You know, he worked at the Orange County Register for 10 years. Hmm. So he always read the travel section because he always wanted to travel, but he never had the money or time. And he'd always come back home with these stories. And, you know, he, one day they covered Ireland in the newspaper and he came home with the clipping to show us. And he would say, oh, like Irish people are like Mexican people, you know, and you have similar cultures and backgrounds, and which is very true. You know, it's just this whole history of colonization and, you know, and dealing with being treated as the other. And so it was really interesting when I went to Ireland, because I was going to, drink Guinness and see the Emerald Isle, right? Yeah. But I learned a lot about myself there. And it was when I decided that I wanted to stop writing for my father's life. I wanted to start writing for my own life. And, and so it was a really time where I explored with different types of writers. I was reading a lot of female narratives. I was writing my theory papers by deconstructing the female characters in the books. I was exploring with fairy tales. I had two great mentors there that were very welcoming and accepting of whatever I talked through in my writing. So it was really cool. And I came back with this idea. I'm like, I'm going to write feminist fairy tales. And, you know, and that's how, and that's how my thesis started in August of 2014. But something else that happened is that I had a story that I wrote my first semester after workshopping, you know, my initial intent to be in the MFA. I was tired of hearing the ridicule of the Spanish language and my culture. So I said, you know what, I'm going to write this crazy story and just put things that I know my peers would react to. And it's something you shouldn't do, right? Because it's a waste of your money. But at the time I was like, so I'm going to really mess them up and think and make them think like, this is a crazy story. So I wrote a story from a house's point of view. And it's a female narrative. And there's a lot of magical, realism and fantasy for fantastic, right? Fantastic aspects to it. The dog talks and the house talks, and all they're doing is observing this female that owns her own house and having these issues of identity because she believes that she should have a man of the house, but she's the woman of the house. And so, like, I wrote this story in my first semester because I'm like, oh, I'm just going to write this for my last workshop because I'm tired of hearing the repetitive, oh, you should write Spanish this way. Oh, you should write about Mexicans this way. So I was like, oh. And then I used, like, feminist terms, like the word woman spelled with a Y instead of the word men in it. And, you know, I made the female, deconstruct her stereotypical things about women and changing her into her own heroine at the end, right? And trekking lightly, because I didn't want to also be this feminist man hater, you know, like get the stereotype of like, oh, you're going to kill off the men and be a villain. He's a villain. I'm like, not necessarily, but I wanted to expose the idea that women have all these obstacles because of how we're typecasted in society and what we're supposed to be. Right. So when that got workshopped, people asked me, why did I feel the need to write in Elizabethan English when I used the word woman? They didn't even realize that it was a feminist term. And so that was like a whole, I was like, oh my gosh, there's no winning in this situation.
Yeah.
So that story is called A Woman's Place. And what I did was take the quote, a woman's place is in the home, and debunked that throughout the story. Right. And that's how these short stories came about. So I went back to that initial story and I said, oh, this is going to be my thesis, which was funny because it was just an experiment. And that's what my collection of female, you know, like the female or the feminist short stories is titled A Woman's Place. I took out the Y because I was like, I don't want people to continue to be confused by whether I'm using Elizabethan English, you know. I'm like, I don't want language to be an issue. And each story that I contributed to my thesis about that is either a quote or a headline that typecasts women into these roles in society. And I try to debunk that in the story. I use a lot of magical realism, a lot of fantasy or fable-like concepts in it. I like when, I really enjoyed writing from inanimate objects' perspectives. Yeah. And so I do that. One story that I wrote, the objects that are talking and telling the story is a replica of a Frida painting and La Virgencita candle. So it's this candle and this, you know, cheap replica of Frida who are talking to each other throughout the story.
Yeah.
And And so like some of those aspects, I think by giving a different point of view and a different perspective, the reader is entertained enough to hopefully continue to read and realize what the story is really about. And it's how women are typecasted into society, into gender roles that aren't necessarily the truth anymore, you know? And what was kind of funny about the whole situation is that my program director kept telling me, oh, maybe you need to change the point of view and just have the woman tell the story. And I'm like, women don't get listened to anyways. That's the whole point of this.
That's happening right here, right now, right?
Yeah. If the woman is telling the story, then I'm just repeating every other story that's been attempted, and we're still not, you know, especially women of color, we are at the bottom of the, you know, of the writing industry. Mm. And so it was a constant battle. But at the time in the MFA, we also had an all-white visiting writers list. Mm. And that just intensified my anger. I deliberately chose the program director to be my thesis director, not because I had rapport with him, because I didn't really have rapport with any of the professors there, but because I felt like, well, maybe if I get to talk to him, I can share with the program director the issues that I had with this particular MFA program. You know, and what happened throughout my last year, it just made me more angry and angry because it was an all-white visiting writers list. And mind you, at the time, there also for adjunct readers, for, you know, readers to read outside from the program, your work, there wasn't a Chicano or Tejano or Mexican American reader either. So it was just this constant, like, how am I going to find rapport and something relatable with a mentor in this space if none of them can relate to me? And when I mentioned the all-white writers list to my then program director and thesis director, same person, he said, I don't see color. I only see writers. So the, you know, fortunately, I finished the MFA. Unfortunately, nobody seemed to care about my complaints or my position in that program. Towards the ending of the program, I even met with the president of the university. I spoke with the vice president. I met with the dean of the English department. I met with the chair, and they listened, but nothing happened after.
Yeah. Okay. So that's unfortunate. But let's talk about, I'm hard to leave that experience.
Yeah, I know. that's why I laugh. Coping skills.
Yeah. But, born out of that in some ways is this upcoming project, I'm assuming, Santana's Fairy Tales, right? That you're going to be doing here in an artist residency. Can you tell us a little bit about what's going to happen, what you have planned? What's going on?
Super excited about that. You know, again, coming back out of like, how did I change my writing in an MFA program? Like we talked about that feminist, you know, short story collection. So the story that is the foundation for Santana's Fairy Tale is a story that I wrote for my thesis. And for me, it's very close to me because it's from something that happened in Santana, where I grew up, my childhood home. It's based on the story of Zoraida, the undocumented trans mujer that was killed in 2014. You know, her murderer was found, but when they reported the story, they made it a man-on-man crime, and they removed her name, and they removed her gender. They didn't report it as a hate crime or a crime against women, and that really upset me, as well as many in the community. And
an erasure.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear you.
An erasure went on. She was erased.
Yeah. And you know, I was here. I was in Austin, so I was keeping up with the story. And I know several people that were dear friends to her. Unfortunately, I didn't have that friendship with her, but I just knew her through social media and knew all the work that she had done. And I've, you know, in passing had met her in person. But I felt this was an important narrative to share because it's a female narrative that gets overlooked many times. And I wanted to make sure that it gets read. And this is how we get into, like, you know, how does creative nonfiction differ from fiction? And I said, well, with creative nonfiction, you know, you put in the facts and you can still write it beautifully with prose and be lyrical. But fiction takes it to this whole other level where you can create elements to the story that keep the reader engaged and almost give it like this double purpose, right? Where what if this changed? Or what if we give it this perspective? Will the reader empathize more? Will the reader, you know, find it to be a stronger story if they're being entertained through words and symbolism and tone versus just learning about the facts of this narrative, right? So that's why I wrote Sorai the Story, and it was really hard for me to take that leap into it because one, I don't want to appropriate. You know, I am not a trans woman. I am not queer. So I wanted to be very careful how I addressed it. And I interviewed one of her, you know, good friends, Alexa Vasquez, who's also a writer. And I wanted to see, like, can I do this? If not, maybe somebody else can do this, but this is my idea. And so I interviewed her. We talked, like, on the phone for an hour about it. And the story went back and forth with her. I sent it to Alexa to read it, and, you know, and I said, you know, I'm not going to pursue this unless I get you to sign off on it, because, you know, it's new ground for me personally. So I did, and I wanted Sorai to be remembered. I wanted her name to be chanted. I want her to be, you know, I made her out to be this fairy godmother for trans women, you know, and taking aspects of Cinderella and taking aspects of, like, of our culture of healing, you know, so that we can heal from this as a community. Mm-hmm. And that's how I came out with the story. And what was interesting during the MFA process, my program director said, oh, this isn't fiction. This is more prose and poetry. And I just said, well, I'm not changing it. And he was like, well, it's too late to change it. You need to finish your thesis, you know. Mm-hmm. But at my thesis defense, the two women that I had on my committee said, that is your strongest story. And they asked me, yeah, where did the story come from? And they had no idea that it was a true story. And so when this happened, and I started sharing the story with some of Soraida's friends, and they were, you know, they enjoyed it and said it needs to get out. That's when I submitted it to Grand Central Arts Center with the proposal. And I felt like if I can do this, another collection of short stories where I interview people, you know, real people from our community, contemporary, you know, narratives of Mexicans and Mexican Americans from Santana, and then put it together in a collection that's full of fairy tales and fables, like, the, you know, inspired from the Grimm's, you know, fairy tales.
Yep.
And give these voices a space of their own, right? Then maybe then we can offset the narratives that are being published in the news headlines that are stereotypes of what Santana is, right? How, you know, gentrification is happening because supposedly we need it to be revitalized. How we need, you know, these new artists to come in to show us what art is, right?
Right.
And so I wanted to counter narrative to all that. Like, we have artists here, we have role models here, we have stories here to tell. You know, we can tell it in two languages, in some cases more, because there's, you know, in our community, there's indigenous languages as well. And so I wanted to attempt that. And I know it's a very ambitious project, but, and, you know, I don't know what I was thinking when I said I could do this in 1 year.
Yeah, it's always that way though, right?
But it happened. I had a couple conversations with, you know, with John at the Grand Central Arts Center. He was very instrumental in helping me see how I can propose this to him, right? And so when I got
the residency, I was so floored that I didn't even pay attention to where the money was coming from and the support. And it was like my boyfriend at the, you know, who's an amazing partner that I have, but he just said, "So babe, are you going to start like wearing all these bright colors?" And I'm like, "What are you talking about?" Like, he's like, "Andy Warhol, you have the Andy Warhol Foundation grant." And I was like, "No, no, no. It's another Andy Warhol. It's not that Andy Warhol." Yeah, and then he's like, "Did you not read it?" And so I had to Google, and I'm like, "Oh my God, I got an Andy Warhol Foundation grant." And it was like, it took a whole day for me to like gain that, like to understand that.
That's awesome. And congratulations for that.
So that, you know, the project, what is it? I'm going to interview my community in English and Spanish. I'm working with local artists to do this, bringing in a graphic artist, hopefully a performance group as well. Music, and we are going to have a multimedia exhibit, which sounds fantastic. And I'm just, you know, I can't wait to get into it. But the whole point is to show the community that this is Santana. This is, you know, this is already here. You don't need to bring people from other areas of the nation or country, you know, or from different countries to show that there's art in Santana. We have artists, we have musicians, we have dreamers, and we have community organizers that are fighting against the gentrification. Yeah. And so I'm going to do the same thing, you know, put in some fantastic and magical realism on the page with real narratives and show, you know, different types of literature publications, from an ebook that will be full color bilingual to chapbooks that are going to be single stories to a whole collection of, you know, possibly around 6 different stories from the community, to a huge classical style fairy tale book that has period binding, that's going to be a one-time only publication in full color, and hopefully will continue to exist in Santana. And so the exhibit will incorporate all of this with the graphic artist, you know, and quotes from the stories on the walls, with an open book presentation, meaning that we will have performers and a live band playing and performing one story. That could be, you know, create this 3D aspect of opening a book, right?
Yes. So for our listeners, do you have a date for
the exhibit?
The main event? Yeah. And or how can they meet you? Or I know you're going to kind of maybe be available during the residency, or kind of maybe step in and see what you're doing.
Yeah, I'm hoping, kind of, and I'm still, you know, working this out, how I'm going to do this, and maybe I'll end up picking your brain, Chris, some more. But sure. I want to create like this, you know, weekly or maybe every 2 weeks, either some sort of podcast or video blog to.
Awesome.
Yeah. To track the project. And that way we can document it as it's being produced. And so the goal is to have the exhibit open in March 2017. Right. Hopefully, you know, by then everything will be put into motion. But before then, I hope to do some kind of blogging or podcasting along the way to build up momentum, but also share the process.
Awesome. And I would be happy to help in any way I
Thank
could.
Thank you.
So don't hesitate to ask. Okay, just kind of in closing, to wrap up, all the projects you do, I think, have a very kind of, a different, I was having a conversation with another interview I did in the podcast, I was at a conference, and they were talking about these other ways of healing and therapy that stand out of the traditional Western models, right? Mm-hmm. And a lot of the things you're doing, I think, are right in those spaces of kind of just acts of healing, acts of different kinds of therapies, these kinds of things. Would you say a little something about how you view, you know, fiction or the work that you do as therapeutic for writers and readers?
Well, I have to say, like, all the writing spaces that I've been part of or created, like Baggio Writers for the Youth, Wild Women Writers for Spaces for, you know, Safe Space for Women, and even, you know, the upcoming project, Santana's Fairy Tales. First and foremost, I mean, for me, writing has been very therapeutic. It saved my life as a teenager, and it continues to give me motivation and affirmation. Not only my multiple, you know, layers of identity that I connect with, but as a human being, right? Because like it's exposed me to amazing writers that write from different perspectives. It's made me find my own community in the writing, industry, whether it's other Chicano writers or other women writers or other artists, you know. So for me, the reason that I find fiction therapeutic, again, it goes back to, you know, using the example of like you're changing the style or the template for the story, right? And you get to enhance details as well as the character that you're choosing to depict. And you get to do it so often and play with it that hopefully there's readers out there that normally wouldn't read about those social justice issues. Well, you know, in fiction, you wouldn't even call it a social justice issue. You just write the story. But to me, there's layers of social justice issues that I write about. You know, one is the female narrative, right? Like so many times women are overlooked, that I want to make sure that we continue to have this conversation of how gender roles are changing in our society. And that includes, you know, the LGBTQIA community as well, right? And so I'm hoping that by using fiction, excuse me, I will be able to obtain a broader audience, obtain and engage a broader audience, right? Because that's what, in order for us to be exposed to different ideas and different cultures, we have to read about them. We have to hear about them. Unfortunately, that's what happens negatively too, right? Through news media and stuff. So right. By putting it on a page, I'm hoping that would offer counter narratives to those negative stereotypes.
Right. Thank you for that. And okay, so how would our listeners be able to find you if they want to learn more about your projects, what's going on?
Well, there's always this lovely thing called social media. So,
yes, of course.
Makes me universal in that way. I'm on Twitter, I'm on Facebook. You can also check out my website, which is sararafaelgarcia.com. And, you know, shoot me an email as well with questions. Hopefully, once I get to Santa Ana, I will have a website with blogging for the project there, too.
That's great. Okay. Thank you, Sarah, for taking the time. I really appreciate you coming on the show.
Thank you.
And I will be paying you visits in Santa Ana to see what you're up to. So, and I look forward to doing
awesome.
That.
Awesome. Great. Sounds like we could do another podcast later then.
That would be awesome. I would appreciate that actually. So thanks again,
Sam.
Well, that's our show. And I want to thank you all for listening again. And I'll have all of Sarah's information, her website link on the show notes. And I'm going to also post a link to some YouTube videos from some of her writing workshops, Barrio Writers, etc. And so look for that. And as always, please send us a message. Let us know how we're doing at theradicaltherapist@gmail.com. Would appreciate any feedback. I still have stickers. I'm still getting requests for them, and I'm going to keep sending them out. You keep asking for them. I'm going to keep sending them out. We have a website, theradicaltherapist.com. We're on Instagram at theradicaltherapist and on Twitter at theradtherapist. So look for us on all the social media. We'd appreciate it. And as always, please rate and review us on iTunes. That's how we get in front of people. We would really appreciate it. So without further ado, my name's Chris Hoff. This has been The Radical Therapist. Thank you.